Hello, this is Beatrice Pivia with part one of the Pantograph for Friday, September 11th, 2026. We begin with page one, where all of the stories are about 9/11, the main one headlined, September 11th, More Than Memory. Livingston County Museum shares local veteran stories. This story is datelined Pontiac. Of the 300 uniforms on display at the Livingston County War Museum, there are dozens that share the stories of veterans who volunteered to serve during post-9/11 military conflicts. U.S. military veteran and curator Ralph Messer highlighted several of these service members, including Sergeant Juan Ruiz, an Army Ranger who served two tours in Iraq and two more in Afghanistan, but was still in high school during 9/11. He was on quite a few Ranger missions where they had high-value targets that they had orders to either capture or eliminate, Messer said. Some of Ruiz's commendations include the Purple Heart, the Combat Infantryman Badge, which is awarded to infantrymen who actively engage in active ground combat, and the Army Commendation Medal with a V for Valor, which is awarded for acts of valor involving direct contact with an armed enemy. He now visits the museum frequently to give tours and talks about special operations, Messer added. The only Green Beret who donated their uniform to the War Museum came from Larry Corrigan, a Pontiac High School graduate who was a Chief Warrant Officer 3, which is a technical or tactical expert responsible for providing direction, guidance, resources, assistance, and supervision to subordinates. Corrigan would direct airstrikes from outside Baghdad during early missions of the Iraq War. He would also serve in the Tora Bora mountain system during the war in Afghanistan. For his service, Corrigan would receive 5 unit citations, which are given to an entire military group for an outstanding bravery or performance in battle, and 3 presidential citations, one of the highest unit-level awards for heroism against an armed enemy. Corrigan now lives in Clarksville, Tennessee, which is just outside of Fort Campbell. Michelle Pfaff, whose grandfather founded Pfaff's Bakery in Pontiac, served in the Maine Air National Guard and the U.S. Air Force, Messer said. Initially, she was responsible for refueling airplanes, fighters, or bombers while they're still in flight. She started out as a boom operator, which means she was in the rear of the aircraft, laying on her stomach, controlling a metal boom that would come down, and she would actually fly it into the fuel receptacle of the incoming aircraft, Messer said. So it would be a fighter, or it could be a bomber, or a cargo aircraft. However, Pfaff eventually went to flight school to learn how to fly these aircraft. After retiring from the Air Force, she worked as an airline captain. Nicole Kelly, a former student of the museum's education director, David Estes, joined the Air Force in 2002 and served on active duty until 2006. She served with the 17th Airlift Squadron as a loadmaster for a C-17 aircraft, which transported food and supplies to avoid land-based convoys. Their motto was, anything, anywhere, anytime. Kelly later moved to the West Coast and works at the Stanford University Veterans Administration Medical Center. But not all veterans recognized at the Livingston County War Museum made it home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The museum uses gold stars to symbolize that a veteran was either killed in the line of duty or died while on active duty. Lance Corporal Raymond Holzhauer was deployed in Iraq in 2007 as part of Operation Iraqi Freedom and worked in the armory in small arms repair. Holzhauer lost his life on March 15, 2007, at the age of 19. Casey J. Kohlmeyer served in the U.S. Air Force from 2002 to 2006 at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha and was Airman of the Year in 2005. But while serving with the Pontiac Police Department in 2013, Kohlmeyer and his canine partner were both struck and killed by a drunken driver. Kohlmeyer is one of a handful of veterans at the museum with two uniforms on display, his blue service uniform and his battle dress uniform. Messer said there are also a number of artifacts collected from Iraq over the last 20 years, including an A24 anti-tank weapon. So named because the barrel is 84 millimeters in diameter, the A24 is an unguided weapon that is rendered unusable after its first firing. During Vietnam, Messer said there was a similar weapon called LAW, a light anti-tank weapon that would get discarded and later used by the Viet Cong as a mortar tube. The museum also has examples of the armor plating utilized by soldiers. Early generations of this plating was primarily ceramic. If a round were to hit it, it would shatter, and that act of shattering would absorb the impact of the round so it couldn't penetrate further, Messer said. And sometimes they would double these up because the vests that they wear have pockets in them where they can insert more armor if they want to. Any display at the Livingston County War Museum that has a green sticker on it includes a video that was filmed by that veteran. Blue stickers indicate that a sticker was filmed by a family member or loved one of that veteran. Many uniforms also include a QR code that links to the museum's website with more information on that veteran's service. We return to the front page, where the next story is headlined, "After 9/11, We Live in Different Times Now." This is written by Bill Flick. So, it was the 11th day of the 9th month, September 11th, 9/11. "Forget that," eerily, that's also what we dial when in distress or deep trouble. It also was 2001. Stanley Kubrick had long forewarned us of that year in his legendary 1968 movie, 2001: A Space Odyssey. But that September morning, back in 01, calm, very calm. In fact, it was such an unnewsy day, sports was splashed across page one instead. "Michael might return," it proclaimed, in reference to the Chicago Bulls' Michael Jordan. In central Illinois, farmers were confident of a good oncoming fall harvest. In a development that would only become a bit foreboding in retrospect, out in Far East Bloomington, a new $15 million Central Illinois Regional Airport terminal was only days from its grand opening, in a time when passengers could still walk with their loved ones straight to their arrival or departure gates without a boarding pass or a second glass. And then came 7:46 a.m. Illinois time on that September 11th, and everything changed, the world included. Wherever you were, it became one of those moments frozen forever. Of my own personal remembrance, I was at Illinois State University's Hovey Hall on that morning in the office of then ISU president and great guy Vic Boschini, doing an interview for a forthcoming fun little piece. And then suddenly we got word. Our meeting just broke. That's how we all also seemed as humans for the rest of the day. Broke, a little lonely, stunned, frozen. We had all watched too many Bruce Willis films, too many Hollywood disaster scenes, too many buildings being flattened in movies like Independence Day. That jet stridently careening into a building, then another. The buildings collapsing almost like some gigantic Hollywood implosion or a game of Jenga. Those Armageddon-like scenes of lower Manhattan bathed in white ash, soot-covered firefighters standing ankle-deep. It all looked so much like Hollywood. Except this time, Hollywood hadn't made it. By 11 that Tuesday morning, everyone was talking. We sought comfort. We phoned people we wouldn't ordinarily phone. We did things we wouldn't ordinarily do. In no time, the malls and other business fronts emptied out. Nobody seemed interested in spending money on anything except internal comforts. By 3 o'clock on that day, all across Bloomington, people were lining up at gasoline pumps because making sure we had plenty of gas, even if we had nowhere to go, suddenly seemed very important. Same with groceries. Spirit stores like National Liquors on Empire were overflowing as well. In a weird twist, by late afternoon, out on the streets interviewing random folk, I encountered David Foster Wallace, the famed novelist of Infinite Jest, who was at the time an associate professor of English at ISU. At that moment, at a neighborhood grocery near downtown, he too was stocking up. We all needed to be well stocked, with no idea what might be occurring next. And then came Wednesday. Back in 1941, after December 7th and that sudden horrendous Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, there was December 8th. After John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, there was always November 23rd. There always has to be a morning after. And back in 2001, after 9/11, there was September 12th. That's when we all began to realize that 9/11 would become one of the biggest datelines in American and world history. "The world awakened today to a new reality," said President George W. Bush back on 9/12/01. "We are in a different time now," said a guy named Donald Trump, a well-known New York City business exec at the time, in fact, watching from his own New York City high-rise the second plane slam into the tower. 9/11, for us and the world, it could also be read 9/1/1. Still to this day, indeed. Our next front page story is headlined, "Teachers Grapple with 9/11 Lessons." This story is datelined Bloomington. Clark Chaplin was literally teaching a civics class the day the world changed. For Daniel McEllen, it was his first day of preschool. Both are social studies teachers today, grappling with how to teach the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks and their aftermath to students born years later. With the kids, some of them just don't see why they have to care anymore. "I mean, we are out of Afghanistan. They don't remember it. They weren't there," said McEllen, who teaches at Central Catholic High School in Bloomington. Clark Chaplin, a social studies teacher at Prairie Central High School in Fairbury, was teaching a civics lesson that day when a student returned to his classroom to announce that a plane flew into one of the World Trade Center towers. Having lived near the Chicagoland area, Chaplin said it wasn't uncommon to hear news that a small plane had flown into a building, but he later heard from a teacher sobbing in the hallway that it was a passenger jet that had collided with the New York skyscraper. Chaplin attempted to turn on the television in his classroom, but the cable was out in his part of the building. He then tried to look for information online using dial-up access, but because everyone else in the world was hearing the same news, he could not log on. Without any new information to share, Chaplin returned to teaching and relied on students from incoming classes for updates, one of whom told him that the first tower fell. At first, Chaplin said he didn't believe it, but after visiting a colleague's apartment during his lunch break, he saw that both towers had collapsed. Once he got home, he had a message from his wife advising him to fill up his car because gas prices were starting to climb. "That's the first time in my life I ever had to wait to get gas," Chaplin said. In the days that followed, one detail Chaplin remembers was how empty the sky was because all commercial air travel was suspended. "You don't realize how common planes flying over are until you realize they're not," Chaplin said. The tragedy was implemented into Chaplin's curriculum within a couple of years as part of lessons on terrorism he taught at the end of the school year. He said most students are not aware of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, which killed six in an earlier terrorist attack. Now that his classes are full of students who were not alive during 9/11, Chaplin said he now must be more precise when he discusses pre-2001 America because the students have no firsthand experience. "That's always an eye-opening moment for myself," Chaplin said. He added that there doesn't seem to be the same level of interest to voluntarily explore the subject as there was 10 to 15 years ago. However, students still wish to make a political argument when the topic is brought up, which is something that Chaplin says he tries to dispel. I had a lot of angry and upset students who wanted to get into political conversations, and I did not feel it was the appropriate place to have that conversation, Chaplin said. I'm providing facts, and while you have strong opinions, I get that, but that is something you can discuss outside of class. McEllen said he is conscious of the challenges teaching 9/11, the challenges they pose to a generation that has no personal memory of the event. McEllen is 28 now, almost 29, and although he does not remember the event well himself, he remembered the changes that came with a post-9/11 America. I'm in the same boat almost as the kids, he stated. I grew up in a post-9/11 America, essentially, without having the memories of it. It's just the aftermath. In his education, he recalled teachers trying to figure out how to teach the subject and how to talk about it. This aids him in his current teaching, he said, as he is able to get on the students' level and explain the importance of the event. However, that too can pose its challenges, he stated. I always have to redirect because, although, like I said, I don't remember it, my dad was a firefighter. He knew people there. I'm big with veterans and just supporting them, and that was a big part of my childhood, McEllen said. The teacher said sometimes students meet the subject with apathy or indifference, which he says can be common in teaching. Regardless, McEllen attempts to teach his students about the matter, noting documentaries he shows to students. Television reporting on the event from that time allows his students to see firsthand what happened and be able to connect to those affected. McEllen said in a high school setting he appreciates the ability to be direct with students about the reality of the event, rather than with younger students who may simply learn this was a sad day, or the immediate aftermath, the sense of patriotism. And with his high school students, McEllen said he's been able to teach kids about the Patriot Act, airport security, and Transportation Safety Administration screening rules, military and foreign policy. And our last front page story is headlined, Navy Veteran Reflects and Asks for Peace. This was written by D. Jack Alkire. I always remember it as a Wednesday. The calendar reminds me that it was a Tuesday. That's memory for you. But I know exactly where I was sitting on September 11th, 2001, in my seventh grade classroom in Rochelle, Illinois, as an adult wheeled in an old tube-powered television on a tall stand, the one we used to watch movies in Bible study. I did not understand that they had turned on the news after the first plane hit the World Trade Center. I cannot remember if we saw the second plane hit, but they sent us home to be with our families that day. Fast forward almost 9 years, and you'd see me leading a company of Navy recruits as we march onto the field of Busch Stadium in St. Louis as the 72nd Cardinal Division. We graduated basic training on November 5th, 2010, meaning that we were at Great Lakes Naval Station for the 9th anniversary of the attacks. In May of the next year, we sat in the barracks of the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California, when President Barack Obama told the nation that Osama bin Laden was dead, but the war was not over. Later that same year in December, I was flying home from Europe aboard a C-130 after an illness landed me in an Air Force hospital in Germany while I was training in Kyiv, Ukraine. They were transporting wounded service members from Afghanistan and Iraq back to the States. I have never seen combat, a statement a younger and more brash me would have lamented, but which I am glad to say now. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs America's Wars page, there have only been 11 wars stretching back to the nation's founding, with the Global War on Terror only listed after a set of footnotes and before the data about living and deceased service members. It's not even listed on this page section. But according to the U.S. Army Center of Military History, the list of recognized armed conflicts in which the flag of the Army was carried is much greater, and according to Naval History and Heritage Command, the list of wars, conflicts, and operations has a scant 34 years of peace in the 20th century, with the section Middle East engagements listed as 1980 to the present. Neither website mentions westward expansion and the subsequent Indian Wars. All that is to say that the U.S. has been in an armed conflict for a lot of its history, with some estimates saying that there have only been about 2 decades of true peace where a U.S. service member was not engaged in conflict. My last day of active duty was in early November 2016, right around the same time as my boot camp anniversary. The last day of my contract as inactive ready reserve was in June 2018. Most people don't realize that every enlisted person's first contract is 8 full years, split between active and inactive, during which the government can compel you to return to active status. And while I did not see combat during my time, I know people who did. I served with them. I've worked with them as veterans transitioning back into civilian life. I have seen what combat can do to their minds and what it can do to their bodies. I have seen what combat can do to a person's soul. Back on that flight from Europe, there was a young man probably a few years older than me at the time. He was in a cot because he had no legs. He had only 3 fingers left on his left hand and no right hand below the elbow. An elderly woman, presumably his mother, had to help him use the bedpan to urinate. For many people, the attacks on September 11, 2001 were the reason they signed up. I knew several who returned to active service because of it as well. Nothing we do can bring back the 2,977 people who died that day, or the countless first responders who got sick and died because they risked their lives to save others. And nothing we do can bring back the 53,556 servicemen and women who died during the global war on terror. According to Stop Soldier Suicide, over 140,000 veterans have killed themselves since 2001, and for 22 consecutive years, more than 6,000 have done so annually. It is the second leading cause of death for veterans under age 45. Now, this Friday, September 11th, 2026, I am asking for peace. Peace to our neighbors, peace to ourselves, peace to our brothers and sisters, and yes, peace in foreign lands. And this next story is headlined 9/11 Terrorist Attacks Marking 25 Years, Wells Crowther, Symbol of Courage. America's teachers keep telling the story of the 9/11 hero. This is a story from USA Today. When the left wing of United Airlines Flight 175 cut through the South Tower Sky Lobby, those who survived the impact did not know if there was a way out. And then they heard Wells Crowther's voice. "I found the stairs," he told them. Crowther led them to safety, turned around, and climbed back into the burning tower. The 24-year-old equities trader saved as many as 18 people on his 3 trips to the 78th floor. He did not survive. And for many Americans, Crowther became a symbol of heroism on 9/11. He received a number of posthumous awards and on Tuesday was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom. His alma mater, Boston College, annually dedicates a football game and road race in his honor. Today, Crowther's story is taught to children in more than 40 states. His heroism is among the defining ways students from kindergarten through high school learn about the terror attacks. This year's class of high school seniors was born 7 years after 9/11. Most first graders were born in 2019, almost 2 decades later. For them, 9/11 is a historical event, not a visceral memory. As educators grapple with how to help the next generation understand the impact of the September 11th attacks, many have come to rely on stories of courage and resilience, like Crowther's, to make the events more tangible. The history is the history, said Crowther's mother, Allison. I say to young people, this happened, it was devastating, but you can't live in fear, and you can't be controlled by fear. She helped develop a curriculum around her son's story called the Red Bandana Project, a reference to the handkerchief survivors saw him wearing on 9/11. The project is aimed at encouraging students to focus on lessons from 9/11, including empathy and leadership. 9/11 should never be forgotten or diminished in any way. It should be addressed in the schools, Allison Crowther said. You have to move forward. Like many who lost loved ones on 9/11, Wells Crowther's family did not know what happened to him until his body was discovered 6 months after the terror attacks. Recovery workers found him lying in debris of what had been the lobby of the South Tower. He was next to a group of about 10 New York City firefighters close to the building's exit. They questioned why he had not made it out. Over Memorial Day weekend in 2002, Allison Crowther found evidence of her son's last moments. In a New York Times article, Fighting to Live as the Towers Died, survivors recounted receiving help from a mysterious man whose face was covered with a red bandana, like the one her son had carried since childhood. Allison Crowther reached out to those quoted and confirmed the man was Wells. He kept going back up, Allison Crowther said. In the years after 9/11, local schools near the family's home in Nyack, New York, often asked Allison Crowther to speak about her son's history. Boston College created a Red Bandana 5K. On the 10th anniversary of the attacks, ESPN released a 13-minute documentary. That shot Wells, the story all around the world, Allison Crowther remembered. As more letters from teachers, students, coaches, and parents flooded her mailbox, she decided to create a curriculum about 9/11 and her son's heroism. For the 25th anniversary, the family's nonprofit, the Wells Remy Crowther Charitable Trust, has revamped it. The new lessons are free, digitally downloadable for teachers, and focused on emotional learning, said Kevin Holbrook, project director of the Red Bandana Project. It includes short lessons for elementary to middle school students on such topics as teamwork, the power of one, and caring for others. The exercises ask students to reflect on Wells Crowther's story and think of other examples they've seen of people helping others. One middle school assignment asks students why someone like Wells might show love and compassion to a stranger. What makes Wells' story so powerful for young people is that he wasn't a historical figure from another century. He was a young man, Holbrook said. He was an ordinary person who made extraordinary choices when it mattered. Crystal Bozigian teaches at North Providence High School in Rhode Island, one room over from the classroom where she watched live coverage of the September 11th attacks. When she first started as a history teacher 20 years ago, all her students had similarly vivid memories of where they were when they saw the towers fall. Some of her students today get the date of the attacks wrong. They don't know why it's referred to as 9/11. That maybe is a piece or a sign that truly it's not a part of their history, the teacher said. And still, every year on the anniversary when she begins her lesson, Bozigian said she sees a quizzical gleam in their eyes. But the lessons also focus on what Crowther's red bandana has come to represent, selflessness. Bozigian asks her students if their generation has experienced any defining moment similar to 9/11. Most point to the COVID-19 pandemic, the shutdowns, the isolation, seeing the death toll rise in news media accounts. For Allison Crowther, she says, embrace the preciousness and the gift of our lives here on earth. That is my wish and my hope for people of all ages. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Panagraph of Friday, September 11th, 2026. I look forward to reading part two with you next.